Good evening, and welcome to Art World Innovators, exploring stories of innovation in the art world. I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and you're listening to UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba. Our guest this evening is Alison Norland, professor and contemporary visual artist known for her large-scale drawings and sculptural installations. Alison received her Bachelor of Fine Arts from the University of Manitoba and her Master of Fine Arts from Yale University. Her work is held in private collections in Canada, the U.S., and public collections such as the National Gallery of Canada, the Mackenzie Art Gallery, the Winnipeg Art Gallery. She has participated in numerous national and international solo and group exhibitions in countries such as Brazil, Europe, the U.S., and more. She is received many prestigious awards for her art, research, and teaching, and international artist residencies in Trinidad and Paris. Alison has been a professor at the University of Manitoba and has been teaching painting and drawing at the University of Saskatchewan in Saskatoon. Welcome to Art World Innovators, and thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thank you, Susan. Thank you for that lovely introduction.
Your intriguing work reflects your lifelong passionate interest in cultural spectacles, existing and imagined architectures and landscapes. Can you elaborate on this passion and how you chose to go into the art field?
It's been a long journey. I actually started first in film at the University of Manitoba, and from there just started taking a couple of classes. I was actually a barber and worked out in St. Norbert and just would drive past the university every day and then started taking classes. And so I think my work actually reflects my love of movies and pop culture and areas like that. But my interest in architecture comes from a kind of autobiographical source. So, for example, something like the Thunderbolt at Coney Island to me represents this tapestry of memories, some of which are quite personal. Also, Follies. I'm really interested in the idea of people building structures that, in a way, for no purpose, just out of a love or a quirky kind of sensibility of making something solely for themselves.
In researching your work, you travel a great deal, exploring your fascination with various cultural landscapes, and then you document your observations and experiences. Can you tell us a little more about your research and describe your artistic process as it unfolds?
One of the things that I've started doing is carrying little tiny miniature books that fit actually in the cup of my hand. And one of the things that I've done in residencies or in research travel is to not take photographs. And I think it's because my work has often been quite obsessively compiling all kinds of information to work as a stimulus. And what's become increasingly more interesting to me is to slow down and to walk around with binoculars and to sit and have to focus and look very carefully and absorb the experience very differently than something, let's say, very fleeting. So what I've been doing is documenting in little tiny books ideas or details about what I'm looking at that might not even be available to the naked eye, and then using those as sources for the work that I do afterwards. And originally, one of the ways that wire started coming into my work was I started building little soldered wire, I'm going to call them maquettes, to think about how those structures are made. What's the integrity of the way that they're standing, for example? And because I come so heavily out of drawing, there's a big difference. And it sounds simplistic, but in a drawing, because it's an illusion, if some of that is missing, it doesn't matter. But when you build it, it has a very different component. So in order to stand, it has to have some of the integrity of its structure. And so that back and forth methodology became very important in my practice. So I make wire sculptures to draw from and then make drawings of my wire sculptures. And so this goes back and forth all the time.
Your sculptures are very large and very intricate. So can you describe one of your pieces to give us a sense of how large scale that is and how intricate it is to create?
Sure. Currently, I'm using a pulse arc welder that can weld as fine as a hair or as big as one of my fingers. And my drawings are very big as well. And I know a lot of Winnipeg artists work very large. It's not the scale that becomes important for me. It's more the experiential quality of a viewer standing and potentially some of the structures being almost the size of, let's say, myself. And it's almost to put you in the mode of being in the place or at the site. And one of the things really interesting is that I often work either very miniature or quite large. And so it's more like trying to have a viewer transported to the site.
And can you give us an example of one of those sites? I know they're based on unusual inspirations.
They are, and it's really eclectic. So everything from collecting things from fairground architecture to the Brighton Pier was a really important source for me, where this place that was historically idyllic then became something which was hit by a hurricane, then it had a massive fire, and then it fell into the ocean. And one of the things both horrific and beautiful was when it fell into the water. And unfortunately, the fire made the structure melt, basically. And so it was something beautiful visually, but also sad and horrific. And it was that sad but symbolic but beautiful component of that moment to me that was really inspiring. And part of it is that some of these structures at one point were really magnificent or meant a lot, like the parachute drop on Coney Island or Thunderbolt, which eventually we just was condemned and then became overgrown with vines and then finally was taken down. It's something about that kind of significance of those things that becomes redundant. I find them really sad that they held such promise and such integrity or fun and escapism and all of these kind of things that we seek out. And then they just get old and they kind of die and they go through these horrible stages in life, much in keeping with what happens to us. It very much is nostalgic. There's a sense in my work when you stand next to it, it becomes sort of a surrogate for our own life experience. And there's a melancholy in that. So while these things are at one point very exuberant and exciting and fun, these particular sculptures actually also have a side to them that's very sad and very iconic and speak to life experience as well.
Another example was your piece Luna, first move into using that new material and drawing on sculptural narratives. Can you tell us about this work and how it led you into new directions?
A lot of it has to do with, in a way, sort of stuff that happens just in the studio that's not really necessarily intended to ever have an outcome. And it absolutely is that process of making something to understand it. So working with that pulse arc welder where you're building something very intricately, almost lovingly, trying to understand its authenticity and integrity through the process of building a little maquette. That show Luna started that way, with just trying to figure these little things out, or these little follies. And then it became actually very integral to me understanding how I wanted to interpret that subject in other media, like my drawings. And so now it's, for me, a way of thinking. It's a way of trying to understand something, and it's become very contemplative, but also, I think, very investigative of that subject. And so it's interesting because then it transformed into making 23 big structures that started to take place, and it became almost like a surrealistic landscape. And it was based a little bit on the collapse of the Brighton Pier. So it starts with that, but then it's a combination of follies. It had a very tiny little replica of the house that I live in, a bridge from Colorado that was abandoned, the bridge here in Saskatoon, the Victoria Bridge that was torn down. It's this real tapestry of things that surround me, but also broader iconic things that other people would recognize.
And something else that might have given you an interesting tapestry surrounding you is during your travels, you've been to the Rio de Janeiro Carnival in Brazil. Can you tell us what you were drawn to there and describe how this may have played out in some of your work and narratives?
I think that's a really interesting comparison, because one of the things that I absolutely loved about the Rio Carnival is the floats tell a story. And so within that 1 hour and all of those floats coming down, there might be seven, and alleys of people and floats that can be 40 feet high with elevators in them and moving parts, and the whole thing tells this unfolding oral story through music, dance, float. And in a way, a lot of them are kinetic. So an example is there was a float that was representing the perils of the earth, and it had explosions, it had horrible things like hurricanes and fires and massive, massive things in a great big screen. But the whole thing was a car wash. And down the sides, women were in showers, and I think they were supposed to be cleansing their souls, but what they were doing is actually tearing the curtains and doing provocative dances. And so you had this mash of contradiction. And I think it's that kind of narrative where it's in the moment and it's really up to interpretation, but it's also freedom of speech. And like the Rio Carnival, on those days, it can attack politics, it can attack what's going on ecologically in the world. It's a voice, and it's like an oral experience that's absolutely unmatched by anything I've ever seen.
bringing it back to Canada, you've involved your public in some of your working process to give them a different sense of understanding. In the roadside attraction piece, the sculptured ice cream cone that you did on site. Can you tell us a little about that?
I was asked into this project, which I think is really fantastic because I love roadside attractions. And in Esteban, they claim the first, though it might be the second, Dairy Queen of the province. And they have a beautiful old traditional Dairy Queen stand in Esteban. And so I wanted to reference that. And so I built a 18 feet by 6 feet tall, toppled over ice cream cone out of coroplast. And I did it at the fair. And timing was very short, so it was this incredibly daunting but interesting experience of building this thing with a screw gun slit coroplast that you could curve. And I did it on site so people could witness me building this. And I had been literally one day to do it. And it was accomplished. And then it was put outside the Esteban Art Gallery. And so it was kind of fun because you're working like a maniac building this kind of ridiculous object, which I had never worked with those materials before. And it was a riot. It was really a lot of fun to work on something which was in a way so absurd, but on the other hand, right up my alley.
And how did the audience respond to actually being able to watch you and almost participating in the experience?
They made me even more nervous because they kept saying stuff like, are you going to be able to get it done? Oh my God, look at how big it is. And they were right in the process, I can say. And because it's something that they pride themselves on locally, because it's one of their icons, it was really fun to talk to them about building this ice cream cone.
And you've also been fortunate to do a few residencies, one in Trinidad and one in Paris. Can you tell us how these experiences have enriched your artistic development and practice? And would you recommend other artists get involved?
I think residencies are really fantastic. And those two in particular were life-changing. And in Paris, I walked around with a little book and didn't have an itinerary on any given day for 4 months. That's when I started doing all these little notebooks. It was really interesting because it just started off as an experiment and a quest to try and limit taking photographs. And within a couple of days of being in the residency, I decided not to take any photographs at all because they were almost superficial. It's so easy to take iconic pictures in Paris. And so instead, I would stand with my binoculars and be able to see the damage that pigeons had done 100 feet high and details of the structures that I was looking at through binoculars. Also, I had to kind of sit and focus. And so it not only took more time, but it made me see differently and made me think about what I was experiencing differently. So even looking in my notebook, I know even what the weather was like that particular day. In Trinidad, what I set out to do was not sit in a studio. I can do that here in Saskatoon. But I decided to go out every day to markets, to every single roti stand I could possibly get to going and listening to all the steel band rehearsals and things like this, and just going out into the heat. And what was interesting is that it wasn't about collecting imagery. It was more about being transported into a place that was so uniquely different from what I had ever experienced before. And so I remember saying to people every single day, oh my goodness, it's so bloody hot. And they said, you say that every day. And it's like, every day it's hot. And it's more putting yourself into this incredible foreign multi-sensory experience. And so I think what happens in that scenario is that it's not necessarily about collecting an image or knowing what you're going to find, but being open to what happens and being receptive to what's going on within that particular time. I love the fact that it's spontaneous. I love the fact it's unexpected. I love the fact that there's not a direct correlation to what you might do with it within your artistic practice, which is very inspiring.
I know when you've spoken about the Day of the Dead in Mexico and a multi-sensory environment there with the lively music and colorful flower arrangements and so many foods and tastes, does this also add to your experience in Trinidad and inform and inspire the multi-sensory aspect of your works?
That's a very, very interesting point, because when I was walking through the flowers, the incense, the smoke, listening to the music, seeing on all the gravestones tequila and the smell of the marigolds, it literally was like feeling like you were in a film set. It was one of the most surrealistic, transporting experiences I've ever been in. And the interesting part is, from our culture, there's something quite sad, intense about dying and being around dead ones. And in this culture, certainly there's that, but there's also this idea that you can visit them every year and that every year they return. And my sense of humor makes me think, oh my goodness, what if you've got old Uncle Frank that's sort of a lecherous, old, unpleasant family member, and every year you get to visit them? Kidding aside, it is really, really interesting. And again, it's because it's an unexpected experience that you can't anticipate in advance. And so there's something wonderful about difference and something new, something foreign, and something that's not predictable.
You also have had an interesting teaching career, and in 2011 you received a Teaching Excellence Award. Growing up, did you ever expect to be a professor of art, and what has been most rewarding about sharing your artistic knowledge with young students?
It's a funny thing because Border Crossings did an article and asked me a question about my teaching. I realized that I absolutely love it. And I'm currently right now just starting a sabbatical. And even during my sabbatical, I'm mentoring graduated students of ours through the CARFAT program to get them started kind of on their next part of their career. And so for me, it never stops. It's interesting because there's no wrongs in this field. And so what I really love about it is that you can do it lazily, you can do it badly, but there's no wrong way. There's so few things in life where we can say that. Just recently this year, I proudly will say I won the University of Saskatchewan Researcher Award. And for people in my field, I'm going to say that that's kind of a rare occasion. And so I'm really, really excited that artistic research, and this is an award that I think is very relevant to my department and showing how artistic practice is as important in those kind of settings as the work of any other scholar. I also won a teaching award this year, which those two together, I have to say, very, very humbling.
Do you have any other exciting projects that you're going to do during your sabbatical or new ideas you're exploring that you'd like to share with our audience?
Sure. In 2018, I was invited to do a collaborative installation at the New Orleans 300th anniversary. And me and a colleague from the University of Alberta built a giant wave that went up about 20 feet up the side of the Jazz Museum. And I'm actually going to go down and do a short week-long research trip in New Orleans in March and get a better sense of what's there. I think I'd like to go into the swamp, and I would like to go into the graveyards, and I'd like to return to contextualize what we might do, but we're going to do a second big project this coming December. So I don't know yet what that's going to be, but we've been invited back to do another project. So that's really exciting. And I've got a couple of exhibitions coming up way up into 2023. So I have a lot of work cut out for me. And currently I'm working on something that very strangely is about fireflies. And I found this article on synchronized fireflies that are in the U.S. where it's like a mating pattern. So the males flashlight at each other and females can tell who they can mate with by the flash of light. And people can actually go to this site, and it's very limited. So you have to buy a lottery ticket. It's $1 to go. But you can lay on the grass and watch this natural spectacle of light above you.
Sounds fascinating.
So I obviously am going to apply for that $1 lottery ticket because they only allow a certain amount of people in. But I've already done one 7x14-foot mixed media work about synchronized fireflies.
And where will that be? Will that be exhibited?
It will be exhibited. I work in series, so I probably will have 3 or 4 of these, and I'm not quite sure yet where I'll be able to show them, but probably in one of the exhibitions that are upcoming.
Great. I'll look forward to seeing that.
I'll keep you posted.
Thank you. Well, I'd like to thank you so much for speaking with us today and sharing your remarkable story and artistic insight. It's been a pleasure, and we wish you continued success.
Thank you so much. And hello to everyone at the University of Manitoba.
That was Canadian artist and Professor Allison Norland speaking with us from Saskatoon. For those of you just tuning in, you are listening to Art World Innovators on UMFM 101.5. Speaking with us from the UK this evening is Paul Cooklin, highly accomplished photographer, recognized for his refined signature style. Paul originally began as a digital artist, creating abstract and conceptual images, but discovered a passion for analog photography and the process of developing black and white film. Paul's portfolio consists of an eclectic collection of prints spanning various photographic genres, which have featured in numerous publications, including Time Magazine, Italian Vogue, and National Geographic. Paul's assignment in Cuba for Time Magazine led to the collection of his artwork in his engaging book publication, Cuba on Film. He is represented by the 508 Kings Road Art Gallery in Chelsea, London, and Saatchi Online Gallery, and more. Paul's photography has been shown in the prestigious 5th Annual Exposure Award, viewed at the Louvre Museum in Paris, in the Black and White Collection. Welcome to Art World Innovators, and thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thank you. I feel honored to be here, really.
Thank you. You're highly acclaimed as a master of analog photography with an intuitive eye for capturing stories of the moment in dynamic compositions and building an extensive portfolio. What drew you into photography?
I suppose when I was doing the digital art thing, and I was working with a company at the time called Brand X Pictures, who are now taken over by Getty Images, I was literally just creating stuff from scratch, you know, all sorts of abstract stuff. And then I was using a digital camera to try to create abstract shapes, which I would then layer up and do all sorts of things with. And I just wondered at the time if I could actually just go out and take a shot and it would be quite good. But I realized quite soon that there needed to be a lot of post-processing and, you know, all sorts of bits and pieces that needed to be done to make it like a finished image. And I thought, you know, I've done that. That's not really what I want to do. And am I able just to be able to go out and shoot and be happy with the shot? And at the time, my dad gave me the Bronica ETRS medium format camera and some film. And I just tried it. You know, at the time, I had a young kid and I just went out and shot some of my kid and some outside. Sent off the negs and they came back and mostly were out of focus, not particularly great. But I liked the look of film. I liked the process. It was much slower. I didn't want to alter anything afterwards. I just knew that if I wanted to create a picture that I liked, then I would have to try harder the other end of the camera, and I didn't want to do any post-processing or anything like that. And that's kind of how I started it. And then I bought some more film, and I went out again, and I learned from that, and I then had an image in my mind, if you like, of what it's like to shoot with film, and that specific film brand and on that particular camera with that lens, you end up building up a database in your mind of, you know, how that looks. And then it slowly started to improve. It's an endless pursuit of a perfection, which I will never, ever accomplish. But, you know, I keep trying it. Just one of those endless things, really, you know, that you're always waiting for the next shot and then you perhaps get some pictures back and you like them. Oh, you know, that one's great for the day. And then you think, oh, actually, I could probably do that better. And, you know, maybe there's this, and you walk around the corner and then there's another shot. And it's an alluring hobby stroke job, which I'm just out there just trying to do, really.
You've also made it your business to market your work through a variety of channels. And what avenues have you explored? And can you tell us about some of the assignments this has led to?
Initially, I signed all sorts of really poor contracts and stuff, and because I didn't really understand, you know, how it all worked, and the business of actually selling prints is very different to going out and taking photos. In fact, it's probably the same as any business. You know, I've always said I could be selling pencils or I happen to be selling prints. So from that point of view, there's certain hats that you have to don and various hoops that you have to jump through. But I've tried a lot of different platforms and spoken to lots of different people, and some have worked and some haven't. Probably the best one has been the Saatchi Art Online. That's where most people, and I think probably yourself, found my work. There was one that led to, I got called by the editor she was then of Time, and she wanted to buy an image of mine, and I, you know, obviously really, really chuffed that she'd even found it, and we agreed a price, and that was great. And whilst we were on the phone, she said to me, oh, you know, do you have any other images of Latin America? And I said, I don't. And as like a little cheeky pun, I said, well, but if you would like to fly me out to Cuba, I'll be happy to do it. And she said, really? And I said, well, yeah, you know, why wouldn't I? So she said, well, look, can you just hold on for like a few minutes? And I went, sure, yeah. So anyway, she came back and she said, all right, then you've been given a go. And I literally couldn't believe it. And it actually wasn't for Time. It was for a sister magazine that she also worked for too. I actually thought this is a great opportunity, and I know that my wife really wanted to go to Cuba too, and I had a young son and an even younger daughter. So we all went, and it was a fantastic opportunity. I don't know if you've ever been, but it's a lovely, lovely place. But obviously, there's some issues over there between yourselves now, but it's just a fantastic experience, and I felt very fortunate to have been asked to go. And I think that quite a lot of the pictures are still quite popular now still, so that's been nice.
Afterwards, you decided to publish a book of your work, Cuba on Film. Can you elaborate on this publication?
In fact, it wasn't my idea. I was asked to do some work with a company called City Pulse by a guy called George Lever in Spain, and I liked him. Although I've never met him, but through email and stuff, you can just get an idea of people. And he had seen my work and said, could we possibly do a book? And of course, I said, yeah, you know, please do. So over the next, I don't know how many months it was, maybe 6 or 9 months, we chose the images. It was obviously going to be a pictorial book. I didn't want to really put down any words. That's not my way. I think if you have to explain it, either you're not seeing it or I've got to try harder. And then the book was published. In fact, it's on my desk now.
Can you tell us how your experience in new cultures or landscapes might inform your work?
I like to travel. Europe's been great. We go to France every year. We try and schedule in for my wife and I to go to at least one city in Europe every year, which I put down as a work trip because it is, in fact, fact, the one we went to Prague, we averaged about 17K a day, which is a lot of walking. All the different cultures, you know, all the different architecture and the smells and the people and the food and the booze. It's all very evocative and emotionally driven and stirring and all those kind of things. And I would do it more if I could. It would be nice to think that at some point that someone might say, look, you know, we want to pay you to go here and, you know, can you go off and shoot? But these trips, they are expensive and they have to be justified. There has to be prints that are then sold because ultimately it is a business. It's not just a hobby. But no, I love to travel. In fact, I would like to come to the States at one point and North America as well. I've got some of my family friends over in the States. So yes, you know, there's loads of countries that I haven't been to, which I'd really like to go to, including India. I've not been there. That will be probably a big one. I've done quite a lot of Southeast Asia. I lived in Hong Kong for 8 years. I've traveled most of Asia. I've done quite a lot of Europe. And I think it's also educational, not just from like a photographic point of view. If we can, we try to take the kids, because apart from going to school and everything else, but there's a wider world out there. And I think that travel is part of their education and it should be explored.
What would you say is involved in submitting your works for stock photos, for example, to Saatchi Online or Getty Images, and how are artists compensated?
Well, that's a contentious issue with me. With like Saatchi Art, they're great. Their support staff are great. They don't edit any images that you put up. They accept it, and then it's down to you. But with the stock agencies, obviously, they're looking for trends and themes and stuff. And when the company that I mentioned first, Brandix Pictures, I liked the editor that I was working with, and she was very friendly, and we'd have phone calls, and it was all very, it would help me along, and you know, that kind of thing. And I thought at the time that the stock image agency was brilliant. I could earn a living from it. I didn't have to do anything else. In fact, coincided with the digital movement, and then everyone could take a picture, and everyone jumped on the bandwagon, and then you got iStock and all those dollar or whatever they charge, you know, for like an image, and it kind of killed it for me. That was my own experience. Perhaps I didn't evolve with it as much, and I didn't broaden myself, but which means that's on me. I just found you had to jump over so many more hoops, and you would get paid much less. I mean, it still sort of irks me that they would take 80%. That just seems wrong. And all of the justification of, well, we've got marketing and we're... No, you're just a big, massive company and you know that you can do this. That really stings. I don't submit any images now to stock. I just think it's a waste of my time and it's not really my bend anyway now. I tend to much prefer the sort of art side of it. I've got much further views on it.
What about some of the collectives in London? There's a couple there, and they can take your work and find ways to exhibit it where they're not charging you the exorbitant commissions.
For stock, not as far as I'm aware, it said it's not really... I know what my kind of like niche is, if you like, and I like the haphazard, lucky, sort of accidental timing kind of work. I don't know whether you've read, but I'm a big fan, or I was a big fan, I should say, of the late Henri Cartier-Bresson, who coined the saying, the decisive moment. And I think that that is what I kind of like, you know, if you can sort of see an image that only works just then at that point, you know, with all different angles and stuff, and someone's in the picture perhaps or not.
You can definitely see elements of his work in some of your photographs.
Oh, bless you. That's such a compliment. And I've only got him to thank for that, really. And also, what a nice bloke. If you've ever listened to him in, you know, like interviews, and that's so down to earth. Just not anything that I thought that he might have been given his pictures. Although, you know, you can look at them and think, oh, he's probably got quite a good sense of humour. Well, that's quite witty. Yeah, no, he is my hero.
Are there any other series that you'd like to talk about that you found most exciting you've done, or something in the works that you'd like to share coming up?
There's nothing planned other than I've got a couple more trips. I've got one going to France again in August, which I always enjoy because I love going to France. That's always a pleasure. And then I think we're off to Spain in November at some time. That'll be like another photographic shoot. And, you know, again, that's always nice. Actually, at the moment, just editing the images from the trip to Prague, which I've just been to, that was lovely. I don't know if you've ever been, but it's a very fantastic city. It's got all sorts going on there and very photogenic.
Well, I'd like to thank you so much for taking the time to share your story and insight with us tonight. It's been a pleasure speaking with you, and I wish you continued success.
Thank you very much, and that's very, very kind of you.
I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and we thank you for listening to Art World Innovators here on UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba. Join us again next Wednesday from 5:30 to 6 p.m. for more on today's innovators in the art world.